My mistress's recovery was so swift that I began to suspect that I had unwittingly invoked some force beyond my own comprehension, and I felt a superstitious awe at my own powers. Her flesh filled out and firmed almost as I watched. Those pitiful empty sacks of skin swelled into plump round breasts once again, sweet enough to make the stone image of the god Hapi, which stood at the doorway to her chamber, burn with envy. Fresh young blood suffused the chalk of her skin until it glowed once more, and her laughter tinkled like the fountains of our water garden. Very soon it was impossible to keep her to her bed. Within 3 weeks of my return to Elephantine, she was playing games of toss, and her handmaidens, dancing about the garden and leaping high to reach the inflated bladder above the heads of the others, until, fearful that she might overtax her returning strength, I confiscated the ball and ordered her back to her chamber. She would obey me only after we had struck another bargain, and I had agreed to sing with her, or teach her the most arcane formulas of the Beo board which would allow her to enjoy her first victory over Aton, who was an addict of the game. Aton came almost every evening to inquire about my mistress's health on behalf of the king, and afterwards to play the board game with us. Aton seemed to have decided at last that I was not a dangerous ghost, and although he treated me with a new respect, our old friendship survived my demise. Each morning my Lady Lostries made me repeat my promise to her. Then she would reach for her mirror and study her reflection without the faintest trace of vanity, assessing every facet of her beauty to determine if it was ready yet to be looked upon by Lord Tunnus. "My hair looks like straw, and there is another pimple coming up on my chin," she lamented. "Make me beautiful again, Taita. For Tunnus' sake, make me beautiful." "You have done the damage to yourself, and then you call for Taita to make it better," I grumbled, and she laughed and threw her arms around my neck. "That's what you are here for, you old scallywag, to look after me." Each evening, when I mixed a tonic for her and brought the steaming bowl to her as she prepared for sleep, she would make me repeat my promise to her. "Swear you will bring Tunnus to me, just as soon as I am ready to receive him." I tried to ignore the difficulties and the dangers that this promise would bring upon us all. "I swear it to you," I repeated dutifully, and she lay back against the ivory headrest and went to sleep with a smile upon her face. I would worry about fulfilling my promise when the time came. From Aton, Pharaoh had a full report of Lostri's recovery and came in person to visit her. He brought her a new necklace of gold and lapis lazuli in the form of an eagle and sat until evening playing word games and setting riddles with her. When he was ready to leave, he called me to walk with him as far as his chambers. "The change in her is extraordinary. It is a miracle, Taita. When can I take her to bed again? Already she seems well enough to bear my son and heir." "Not yet, great Egypt," I assured him vehemently. "The slightest exertion on the part of my mistress might trigger a relapse." He no longer questioned my word, for now I spoke with all the authority of the once dead, although his previous awe of me had worn a little thin with familiarity. The slave girls also were becoming accustomed to my resurrection, and were able to look at my face without having to make the sign. Indeed, my return from the underworld was no longer the most popular fare of the palace gossips. They had something else to keep them busy. This was the advent of Ak-Horus into the lives and consciousness of every person living in the land along the great river. The first time I heard the name Ak-Horus whispered in the palace corridors, I did not immediately place it. The garden of Tiamat beside the Red Sea seemed so remote from the little world of Elephantine, and I had forgotten the name that Hui had bestowed on Tunnus. When, however, I heard the accounts of the extraordinary deeds ascribed to this demigod, I realized who they were speaking about. In a fever of excitement, I ran all the way back to the harem, and found my mistress in the garden, besieged by a dozen visitors, noble ladies and royal wives, for she had so far recovered from her illness as to resume once more her role as court favorite. I was so wrought up that I forgot my place as a mere slave, and to be rid of them I was quite rude to the royal ladies. They flounced out of the garden, squawking like a gaggle of offended geese, and my mistress rounded on me. "That was unlike you. What on earth has come over you, Taita?" "Tunnus," I said the name like an incantation, and she forgot all her indignation and seized both my hands. "You have news of Tunnus? Tell me quickly, before I die of impatience." "News, yes, I have news of him. What news? What extraordinary news! What unbelievable news!" She dropped my hands and picked up her formidable silver fan. Stop your nonsense this instant, she threatened me with it. I'll not put up with your teasing. Tell me, or I swear you will have more lumps on your head than a Nubian has fleas. Come, let us go where nobody can hear us. I led her down to the jetty and handed her into our little skiff. Out in the middle of the river, we were safe from the flapping ears that lurked behind each corner of the palace walls. There is a fresh, clean wind blowing through the land, I told her. They call this wind Achorus. The brother of Horus, she breathed it with reverence. Is this what they call Tanos now? None of them know it is Tanos. They think he is a god. He is a god, she insisted. To me, he is a god. That is how they see it also. If he were not a god, how then would he know where the shrikes are skulking? How else would he march unerringly to their strongholds? How would he know instinctively where they are waiting to waylay the incoming caravans and to surprise them in their own ambuscades? Has he accomplished all these things? She demanded in wonder. These deeds and 100 others, if you can believe the wild rumours that are flying about the palace. They say that every thief and bandit in the land runs in terror of his life, that the clans of the shrikes are being shattered one by one. They say that Achorus sprouted wings like those of an eagle and flew up the inaccessible cliffs of Jebel Bahari to appear miraculously in the midst of the clan of Busti the Cruel. With his own hands he hurled 500 of the bandits from the top of the cliffs. Tell me more, she clapped her hands, almost capsizing the skiff in her enthusiasm. They say that at every crossroads and beside every caravan route, he has built tall monuments to his passing. Monuments? What monuments are these? Piles of human skulls, high pyramids of skulls, the heads of the bandits he has slain as a warning to others. My mistress shuddered with delicious horror, but her face still shone. Has he killed so many? She demanded. Some say he has slain 5,000, and some say 50,000. There are even some who say 100,000, but I think those must be exaggerating a little. Tell me more, more. They say he has already captured at least 6 of the robber barons. And chopped off their heads? She anticipated me with ghoulish relish. No, they say that he has not killed them, but transformed them into baboons. They say he keeps them in a cage for his amusement. Is all of this possible? She giggled. For a god, anything is possible. He is my god. Oh, Taita, when will you let me see him again? Soon, I promised. Your beauty burns up brighter every day. Soon it will be fully restored. In the meantime, you must gather every story and every rumour of Achorus and bring them to me. She sent me to the shipping wharf every day to question the crews of the barges coming down from the north for news of Achorus. They are saying now that nobody has ever seen the face of Achorus, for he wears a helmet with a visor that covers all but his eyes. They say also that in the heat of battle the head of Achorus bursts into flame, a flame that blinds his enemies, I reported to her after one such visit. In the sunlight I have seen Tanos' hair seem to burn with a heavenly light, my mistress confirmed. On another morning I could tell her, they say that he can multiply his earthly body like the images in a mirror, that he can be in many different places at one time, for on the same day he can be seen in Quenna and Komumba 100 miles apart. Is that possible? She asked with awe. Some say this is not true. They say that he can cover these great distances only because he never sleeps. They say that in the night hours he gallops through the darkness on the back of a lion, and in the day he soars through the sky on the back of an enormous white eagle to fall upon his enemies when they least expect it. That could be true, she nodded seriously. I do not believe about the mirror images, but the lion and the eagle might be true. Tanos could do something like that, I believe it. I think it more likely that everybody in Egypt is eager to set eyes upon Achorus, and that the desire is father to the act. They see him behind every bush. As to the speed of his travels, well, I have marched with the guards, and I can vouch for... She would not allow me to finish, but interrupted primly. There is no romance in your soul, Taita. You would doubt that the clouds are the fleece of Osiris's flocks, and that the sun is the face of Ra, simply because you cannot reach up and touch them. I, for my part, believe Tanos is capable of all these things. Which assertion put an end to the argument, and I hung my head in submission. In the afternoons, the two of us resumed our old practice of strolling through the streets and the marketplaces. As before her illness, my mistress was welcomed by an adoring populace. and she stopped to speak with all of them, no matter their station or their calling. From priests to prostitutes, none was immune to her loveliness and her unfeigned charm. Always she was able to turn the conversation to Achorus, and the people were as eager as she was to discuss the new god. By this time, he had been promoted in the popular imagination from demigod to a full member of the pantheon. The citizens of Elephantine had already begun a subscription for the building of a temple to Achorus, to which my mistress had made a most generous donation. A site for the temple had been chosen on the bank of the river opposite the temple of Horus, his brother, and Pharaoh had made the formal declaration of his intention to dedicate the building in person. Pharaoh had every reason to be grateful. There was a new spirit of confidence abroad. As the caravan routes were made secure, so the volume of trade between the Upper Kingdom and the rest of the world blossomed. Where before one caravan had arrived from the east, now four made a safe crossing of the desert, and as many set out on the return journey. To supply the caravan masters, pack donkeys were needed in their thousands, and the farmers and breeders drove them into the cities, grinning at the expectation of the high prices they would receive. Because it was now safe to work the fields furthest from the protection of the city walls, crops were planted where for decades only weeds had grown, and the farmers, who had been reduced to beggars, began to prosper again. The oxen drew the sledges, piled high with produce along the roads that were now protected by the legions of Achorus, and the markets were filled with fresh produce. Some of the profits of the merchants and the landowners from these ventures were spent in the building of new villas in the countryside, where it was once more deemed safe to take their families to live. Artisans and craftsmen, who had walked the streets of Thebes and Elephantine seeking employment for their skills, were suddenly in demand, and used their wages to buy not only the necessities of life, but luxuries for themselves and their families. The markets were thronged. The volume of traffic up and down the Nile swelled dramatically, so that more craft were needed, and the new keels were laid down in every shipyard. Captains and crews of the riverboats and the shipyard workers spent their new wealth in the taverns and pleasure houses, so that the prostitutes and the courtesans clamoured for fine clothes and baubles, and the tailors and the jewellers thrived and built new homes, while their wives prowled the markets with gold and silver in their purses, looking for everything from new slaves to cooking pots. Egypt was coming to life again, after being strangled for all these years by the depredations of Akseth and the Shrikes. As a result of all this, the state revenues burgeoned, and Pharaoh's tax collectors circled above it all with as much relish as the vultures above the corpses of the bandits that Achorus and his legions were strewing across the countryside. Of course, Pharaoh was grateful. So were my mistress and I. At my suggestion, the two of us invested in a share of a trading expedition that was setting out eastwards into Syria. When the expedition returned 6 months later, we found that we had made a profit of 50 times our original investment. My mistress bought herself a string of pearls and 5 new female slaves to make my life miserable. Prudent as always, I used my share to acquire 5 plots of prime land on the east bank of the river, and one of the law scribes drew up the deeds and had them registered in the temple books.